From deep inside a fermentation tank in a downtown brewery, this is Main Street Mesa.
So, Ryan.
Yeah.
I hear that you were visiting a small university outside of Boston recently.
Yes. So, no, I like this opportunity that I think we shared with people who might listen to previous episodes, where just messing around with Jeff Speck on the Twitters and challenging him to pay for my tattoo of 10 Steps to Walkability. He says, no, I have a better idea. How about you come out to this little place in Cambridge, Mass. Called Harvard.
Do this
The Walkable City course that he teaches, or co-teaches, with George Proakis, who's also a really funny guy, who's the planning director for Somerville.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're familiar with your Boston geography, you head north from Boston, you hit Cambridge, and then you hit Somerville. And Somerville is a city of only 4 square miles, but punches pretty high above its weight class.
I have a gentleman that I went to ASU with is a planning human at in Dan. Somerville. Dan Bartman.
Dan,
yeah.
Bartman. I did run into him.
Is that it was on the father of the on the group of people that began to sort of like professionalize tactical urbanism.
Very cool. Well, I'm proud to know that Dan went to ASU with us and carrying on the good work in Somerville, Mass. While I was there, he did drop the joke of, yes, in Phoenix, they argue. They have 6 lanes of traffic, and they're like, but there's no room for a bike lane! And so that was like the joke line in Somerville, where most arterials, mind you, are 2 lanes, 1 lane each direction, and a nice bright green bike lane.
They can afford that paint.
You know, Somerville's...
But they have nicer weather.
Oh, yeah. the Nor'easters are lovely. But the one thing that I learned about Somerville is that it has this amazing political leader of a mayor who has run on the idea that Somerville should be the most walkable and bikeable city in America.
It's not a very tall order.
I'm so happy with this guy's line. And you're like, but if you think about where the bar is at.
I mean, what? Mesa's a platinum bike league of bicycle cities?
Silver. It's
silver. It's the same color.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure where that rating system comes from.
It's just a measurement of miles. We have more... We have more miles of protected bike lanes than Somerville.
That's not the case.
Not per capita, and not per mile of roadway, but we definitely beat it in quantity.
If we just keep on expanding and expanding and expanding the boundaries of Mesa,
we have more freeways than Rome.
Eventually, we'll have something that's nice somewhere.
What? If we go far enough east, we'll incorporate Rome through Tokyo and Beijing and let's see. I just looked at the area. You know, since 1970, our population has grown 625%? And I don't know the exact difference in land planning area, but we went from 1 square mile to, like, 30 years later, 2 square miles, to, like, 10 years later, 7 square miles, to today, 137. Just like Somerville, in Cambridge, in Boston.
Yeah, so if Somerville can do it with 4 square miles, we can do it with 138.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
How about we just beat Somerville in 4 square miles? Heck, one.
That I think is a good place to start. We not to set the bar too high, but I mean that's our whole motivation for even doing this. Like, we're sitting around and trying to include people into a conversation about the optimal use of a small footprint of a downtown and create something that resembles a traditional neighborhood where people actually want to be, not just settle for.
Well, give our community options that don't exist otherwise.
And,
or at least talk about it.
So there's two things that we want to talk about in this podcast before we get too far into our...
Your small city outside of Boston, yeah, small university outside of Boston.
My experience in the walkable city. But we should also celebrate the fact that Chuck Marone from Strong Towns is making an appearance August 8th at that little downtown park in
the Phoenix. AE England community building, which was an old car dealership, I think.
Is it inside or is it outside?
I believe it's outside. It said AE England. It was, which is at City Space Park.
City Space Park, yeah.
So. It can fit 400. They're planning on 200. Let's fill it with Mesa people.
Yeah, and bring water, because it's an outdoor event in August.
It's an indoor event.
Indoor event.
Indoor event. They have an entire auditorium that seats 400 people.
Oh, see, the park thing was what was throwing me for a loop.
It's just AE England building. Mm-hmm. Building is your indicate building. That is the enclosed structure.
Okay.
Within which it is part of the Civic Space Park.
It is within the park.
With the lovely Janet Eckelman jellyfish thing.
Hmm. Yeah, the beehive net, as I like to think
of it. I've heard it described as a diaphragm, a used condom.
The fact that nobody knows what it is actually the beauty of it. It's because it becomes this...
Well, I know what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be resembling a saguaro blossom.
Hmm. Well, see... But it's,
do you know the name of it?
It's a conversation piece. The conversation piece.
How'd you know? The name of it is Her Secret is Patience.
There's probably a plaque in there that says that.
I don't know. She named it at the unveiling. Like, I was actually at an ASU class across the street. And we got out early so we could make it to the dedication ceremony for the art piece.
Cool.
And she went through her whole thing is that she never names a piece until the dedication ceremony. So maybe.
Hmm. A way to keep everybody in suspense while they're paying this thing.
Cost like $1 billion. Art's expensive, especially.
At that scale?
At big scales, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
It is cool, and people talk about it all the time. So, regardless if you like it or not,
Pave it. Add another lane.
So.
That could have paid for like a quarter of a mile of one lane roadway.
Who's this Chuck Marone guy, and why should we care about him?
I don't know. You stalked him when we were in Savannah.
He put his arm around me, David.
You were touched?
So, you guys heard us talk about Strong Towns, right? And so the thing is that the Strong Towns carries a lot of messages that we certainly get behind and resonate with us with regards to how a city should be built in a way that is human-scaled and not over-engineered and not fiscally...
And do the math.
Yes, hashtag.
Do the math.
The math. So, yeah. We may have run into Joe behind Urban 3, who had these incredible stickers that probably ended up on the back of your laptop.
They certainly didn't land up anywhere else.
One of the stickers had the count from Sesame Street, which is
one.
Because, you know, cities need to go back to the basics on how they do the math on whether or not they're fiscally solvent.
Yeah. Joe talks about it as cities measure their spending like we measure the gas mileage on our car, but not in miles per gallon, but in gallons per mile. And it's a perverse measurement and not a true one, a useless one. You know, oh, my Ferrari, you know, it only uses 1 gallon a mile.
Yeah, so thinking in terms of how many miles to the tank that Mesa gets.
Right.
It would seem that if we grow bigger, we'll do better. Right? We grow the size of our gas tank. It doesn't matter how inefficient our engine is running.
We just build a bigger gas tank and we'll solve the problem.
Yeah, and so that is a very powerful metaphor and one that I think it just gets right to the root of the problem. And if cities actually cared about the efficiency of how they ran, they would do so by looking at the productivity per acre, or at least square mile, or per district, or...
Heck, we could do, like, some sort of per 10 square miles. Let's just measure it. Let's talk about it. Let's have that conversation and find out where is our land being productive and where are we sucking our city coffers dry or creating spaces where we're becoming fiscally insolvent in the future. If you were to run out our budget, mm-hmm. and someone needs to, hashtag
do the math.
Find out, you know, what, without bonding constantly, we've built infrastructure, thousands and thousands of miles of infrastructure out to every corner of Mesa, and we're not budgeting and we're not saving for the eventual replacement of that infrastructure.
How do we save when we don't even have a primary property tax?
Well, we use utility bonds.
Or general obligation bonds.
Yeah. Well, and the bonding becomes a secondary property tax.
We've got to pay and down that debt somehow.
Sales tax, which is fabulous. Amazing. It's heroin for cities. someone described it as. And... Which I find funny as a way of funding our city when we are basically a bedroom community. Mm. Our jobs per household are low. Tempe has about 2 jobs per household, and we have like 0.0. It's very low. I need to go look. It's not even 0.1. Or maybe it's like 0.2. 0.2 sounds right. It's been 0.2 or 0.3. But that's not good. No. One, because our residents have to drive far away to get jobs. Mm-hmm. But that's where they end up spending their money. That and on the website owned by the Bezos.
Yeah, because... Who can walk to the store when you can just have UPS drop off stuff? Like that, right? Well, it goes back to the traditional neighborhood concept, right? We just are incomplete in how we are building out Mesa.
We did it right for so long, but now we've done it wrong for almost as long.
And what keeps me up at night is this idea that somehow we can retrofit the suburbs, which I think is an interesting debate that we saw at TMU, right? There's like this split between people who believe it can be done, and these people are like, there's just too much of it. Let's just quit.
But we built the suburbs. I mean, that all got built. So the idea that it could be retrofitted, you know, once it's built, it's harder. It's more difficult. But it should be possible. It
should be.
It's just, there's a lot of it. I mean, a huge amount of it that I worry, and I think we all worry about, is not very resilient. So if we hit a bump in the economy, we saw that 10 years ago. If we have some sort of environmental disaster, or if we listen to Andres Duany and his thing, it's just like, all right, when everything collapses, maybe not this generation, but 100 years from now, what cities are going to survive? You know, you were on that podcast. You listened to that one live. That was that was Strong Towns podcast, and they're talking about resiliency. They're talking about how Savannah is probably all right, and Andres is like, "You need to Savannah. They need to take an ownership of their nuclear power plant. They need to build a fishing fleet so they can have that ancestral knowledge. Because when everything goes to hell, there's going to be places like this that survive."
One of his best pieces of advice is just like, if you want to win, burn down the competition.
Yeah, that was in that.
That's really what you do. I mean, maybe metaphorically, but yeah, it's what you do.
But, you know, his comment there, and I can't decide if he's 50% insane or 50% genius.
Is that most of his?
Or it is the same. You know, it is both. All of the things he say are both half insane and half genius. And it really made me think about the next 100 years here in the Valley and how we are really terrible about thinking regionally. If we think of this as a Mesa versus Gilbert versus Tempe versus Phoenix versus Glendale versus Surprise versus El Mirage versus Goodyear versus Litchfield Park versus... It's a losing battle because we're all part of the same infrastructure. We're all part of the same watershed. We're all part of the same power shed. That was a term that he used that was new to me that made me think about it. You know, we all get the power from the same place.
Think about your shed.
And yeah, we don't think about resiliency and we don't think about long-term sustainability in our budget. Hashtag.
Do the math.
We'll make this a thing.
We're doing our part, Joe.
We're not doing the math. We're not taking a look at it. We're not being good stewards. And you know what is fascinating to me about the Strong Towns message is that it is neither liberal or conservative, or actually it is a very conservative message. A very conservative message. Look at your budget, do the math. Find out what it is. Don't go into huge amounts of debt. That's a very traditional conservative, maybe not a currently conservative message, but that's a very conservative message.
It doesn't have a ton of fundamental like equity built into their conversation, right? If anything, maybe intergenerationally equitable or...
Right.
Right,
but it's not addressed. That, you know, it's not a very liberal space. But it's not as crazy libertarian as, oh man, what's his name? Clusterfuck Nation. Kunstler. Dean Howard Kunstler, is that his name? Yeah. Howard Kunstler?
Howard Dean?
Howard Dean. Oh, yeah. He runs a website called Clusterfuck Nation, which is hyper libertarian, which I read as well. That is very interesting to read.
I totally enjoy having my views challenged by libertarian thoughts all the time, and I think that there's a fair amount of good stuff to borrow from that. My only thinking is that it's not robust enough to kind of be adjusted for the abnormalities or human behavior, and it's kind of, you know, in a rational world, this should work. And
the more and more we learn about humans is that we are not rational actors. I was just listening to Malcolm Gladwell talking about behavioral economics and how we were finding out that our economic system is based on humans being rational actors. And we are learning... scientifically now, I mean, I think we've all known it forever, but scientifically now that we are not rational actors.
Right. When was behavioral economics actually like accepted like into the mainstream of economics?
It like started until the 90s, yeah.
80s, 90s, so.
Although the roots of it go back to the 40s and 50s, but...
I would say that you can even see it in Adam Smith's So, I mean, like, it's been around. It's just not been acknowledged as a thing.
Yeah, it was just like, oh, economics. And it just got taken over by math. In the 50s, they're like, math! Math will solve all of our problems. Hashtag, we need to do things in addition to doing the math.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, by not focusing on the idea that behavioral economics is in itself worthy of a lot of mind space, you can easily kind of overlook it and go back to the rational thinking without being challenged enough.
There we go. Always be prepared. That's what I learned.
If I'm going to bring this back to the Harvard course, though...
well, why don't we finish up Strong Towns?
Oh, okay.
So...
Weave it in.
Let's weave it in. Right. This is a rambling thing anyway, yeah. Always, and that's part of our charm.
And I think that...
That's why our wives love us.
If we take, like, Chuck Marone and put him into a silo, and Jeff Speck and put him into a silo, and not think about how their messages marry, what are we doing here? We just...
But I want to know why should a Mesa resident go to this August 8th event on the first day of Mesa Public Schools being back to school? Like, why should I...
Go back to school, folks.
Go back to school, to the school of the Strong Towns.
Yeah. Because, obviously, we're desperate for the message.
How do we share that message? Because we have 500,000 people in our community mm-hmm. that aren't going to go to this event.
But totally listening to this podcast right now.
Well, yeah, that's a required. Didn't we pass that rule?
Yes, we need to get that.
In the churchyard, we're like, hear ye, hear ye.
So Chuck has a way, I think, of getting his message across in a way that is, like you said, it's not liberal. It's not
politically coded, yeah, right?
It's totally something that everybody can appreciate. And if hearing us ramble about it doesn't quite sink in, getting there into the community and seeing how many people appreciate it and being part of that event and being part of that community is a great way to help ingrain that into, I think, all of our political and cultural thinking. Because in order to talk about this idea, we already covered the fact that there's so much sprawl repair that's required if Mesa's going to have a financially... productive future. You have to start with like a cultural revolution, and that cultural revolution doesn't happen in a silo.
And the cultural revolution is really doing the math and being honest with us and having with ourselves and having a good amount of self-reflection that says, you know, if we want to talk about sprawl repair, and we're going to have to. Why do we have to talk about it? It's like, because we've built fiscally insolvent communities. Our infrastructure is not supportable. And we have to start with that. What do we have? We have to have honest self-reflection. We need to look at our household budget and say, how do we get to not spending more than we have? Or being like strategic with our debt, because debt's not necessarily evil.
Right.
But we have to be able to pay it off, and we have to have a plan to pay it off. We go into debt to buy our house, mm-hmm. some of us, buy a car, some of us. And those are things that we do. So how do we make sure that we're not over-leveraging our debt? Mm-hmm. And how do we have that conversation as a community of 500,000 people that spend half of their time in a different city going to work?
And we have to realize that there's some things that are definitely need to be thought about in the terms of like return on investment, and things that we're doing because it's just quality.
Well, right. You know, like a park, for example, while there is a measurable return on investment, it is not necessarily a cash return on investment. And so we have to invest in things, and you invest in values too.
Mm-hmm.
How you use your money, and sometimes purchasing things that maybe don't have a return on investment, but bring you pleasure. Your Netflix subscription, your Jeff Bezos subscription. I'm trying to think of, but I mean, like going out to eat for dinner, that is not a... you're not getting return on investment in any food when it's talking about a monetary value, but it's needed. But then you add on top of the pleasure aspect. and that part of it, or convenience, or things like that, and you get something out of it. But if you go out to eat too much,
and does anybody like going out to eat to a restaurant that's empty? Like where you're like, there's not that little nice like social rumble in the background, and you're like, it feels weird. I've been in a restaurant where like you're the only person there, and you're like, the food's not that bad. Why is this happening?
What do other people know?
The reasons why it's happening is because the Sheraton ended up in the middle of Mesa Riverview Park, and nobody ever thinks that that's a place to be to go to a restaurant.
Two restaurants.
Oh, yeah. Three. Well, yeah. Two. The sports one. And
the sports bar and then the fancy one.
Fancy. Now it's fancy Mexican.
Oh, it's no longer the steakhouse?
No longer the steakhouse.
I ate there. It was good. It was empty.
Empty.
And very expensive.
I'm like, who decided to put this building out in the middle of a field? Anyways.
Because Wrigleyville West is going to take over that entire corner. Yeah. It's just going to be the middle. It's going to be the hubbub of the hustle and bustle of that core pseudo-urban experience. No, and you're right. Like, if you have a hotel is a destination location, but restaurants, especially if you have restaurants that are hitting a higher mark, you want to have the outside community come, and it does not advertise those places with its physical presence, with how you get them through like weird long corridors back. If you go to that apparently now Mexican restaurant, you have to like walk through the front door and then back past the Starbucks, down past the bathrooms.
Yeah, you're trying to like find the door that's open. You're really like half the doors are locked. And it's really weird.
Architects, so, man.
Like, get your ground game right, guys. Like the space is, as you approach a building, between the buildings, around the buildings, that's urban design. And no city.
It should be architecture too, guys.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Like, even if a city is going to try to regulate that, that's not like something that we typically have the expertise on staff to try to nudge it in the right direction. Like,
well, your higher self interest in building and a huge investment, mm-hmm. you would hope that you want a return on investment. You hope that you would want to be profitable. And how you design your building is a lot about your profitability.
Yeah. But unfortunately, landscape architects aren't used in this capacity, or landscape and urban designers. Like, there's really, like, between the architect and the planner, there's two professions that help bridge that gap. Landscape architects and urban designers. Like, so there's those two specialties that can kind of help make all this work better. But anyways, that's... a little bit
of strong town, strong town. Away
from the agenda topics, right? So,
but that's a weak building, and weak buildings do not build strong towns.
That is true. Thank you for bringing us back to strong towns, there we go. David.
That was just segues all day.
It's so, but the point that I bring up the empty restaurant thing is it's a way to try to understand, like, by coming out to the strong towns event, you're coming to a very busy, robust, humming community that is building around the message of strong towns. And we're part of that. Like, we are very much a spinoff of the strong towns message, bringing in our own ideas, bringing in members of the community to try to apply that to Mesa. So let's not allow this community to be an empty restaurant. Continue to invest in building that community, and that community then helps push forward that cultural evolution that we're talking about that's necessary as a first step. And I like your, we have to admit that we have a problem. That really started sounding like a 10-step program to Mason's addiction to sprawl.
Yeah, first step is that we acknowledge we have a problem.
Yes.
But I don't like the step two, which is, hi. Soder, you're enjoying hanging out here.
We have a special guest on the program.
All the time.
Mikey and I.
And step two is acknowledging you're powerless, but we're already off. I don't like this. I think in there you can only God can solve your problem here. Look, guys, we built it. We can fix it.
Yes. There's no prayers that are needed in this.
I'll take all your thoughts and prayers. All as much as you need to do that. That's great. But that just means you're thinking about the problem.
Yes.
And we meditate need to do that. Meditate, pray, however that works in your experience. Well, the same thing with the restaurant. If you ever go to a large but well-run restaurant, and if you're there early before the dinner rush, you'll notice that they'll keep rooms unoccupied. They won't seat anyone into a room, a section. They want to keep people together because people like hanging out with people, and it's a better dining experience if you're in that. So as the night goes on, they start opening up other sections, and that's why you might go in, and they're like, oh, we don't have a table. And you're like, there's a table right there. And you're like, well, we might not have the diner, the server, to help with that. The infrastructure to expand to that next room before we have the enough diners to make it feel right. The density. Oh, man, this is going all right. Look at this. Like, you need to have, you have to have enough people to make it feel right so you have a pleasant dining experience. And you have to have the resources, the infrastructure, to be able to reach those new areas. Look, cities are restaurants. I'm just that's it. Let's write a book.
We're writing a book. Cities are restaurants. But who's the hostess? Would that be like a mayor or?
No, it's more like planners. That's not what planners do. Planners don't organize like that. Maybe they should. But it's really like city management. How do you reinvest resources? How do you operate that? City council's in there too. So, you know, your maitre d' is really the city leadership.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah, we have ourselves a little bit. We'll have to explore that a little bit more maybe sometime.
Yeah. But a small university outside of Harvard.
So I hope that everybody's got their
outside of Harvard. Damn it.
Hopefully now everybody's got the reason that why they need to go to the Strong Towns events. August 8th, 5 o'clock, downtown Phoenix. Be there. Okay.
And they have food.
And I think we should bring water or something. I don't know.
I mean, you should bring water anytime you go outside.
I'm thinking water with a label on it that says compliments of Main Street Mesa. You guys...
You want to use disposable?
Yeah.
Like, we need swag. Disposable. We need swag. Yeah. That's right. We'll just do stickers.
Nice. Yeah. Do the math. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, so transitioning to the experience in Cambridge, Mass. That was awesome. So I get to do this incredible executive level course. Thanks to the invite of Jeff Speck. And then day one starts off with like his greatest hits. So 70% of it I've heard before. you might realize I read the book.
Here's the Kool-Aid. Drink it.
I read the book The Walkable City. I reread the book section by section with a lot of notes in preparation for podcasts.
Perhaps discussing episodes. Topics.
Yeah, you know, exploring those topics with people on this podcast and David. And others.
I'm not a person. You had to say people and David.
Yes. You subhuman.
Subgenius.
So that was good, but like so 70% of it, it was like, all right, I've heard this song before. But the 30% that was untapped was, hey, all right, I know that you've been thinking about this stuff since 2011 or earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Where have you evolved in those 7 years? Like, what are you figuring out? What's on the cusp? And I know that he has a new book coming out, The 101 Rules of Walkability.
Which is a lot more than 10 steps.
10 steps, yeah. He's trying to... He realizes that...
It's an order of magnitude larger.
Not everybody has the imagination needed to take rules and translate them into actions. So he's like, all right, let's just cut through the bullshit.
Do this. Here's 100 things. Yeah, do it.
We're just going to make these little things doable. So I realize, you know, he's working with an audience and not everybody understands, you know, has that creativity. And not everybody is a creative. So, you know, if the more that you can empower people, even if they don't have creative genius on how to translate
rules or excuse, right? Which is why engineers are so successful in what they're doing. They might be working on the wrong playbook, but planners aren't, because they don't have a code book that says, "Ooh, it must be this way." It's like, "Oh, when they're writing the code book, they can say, "Ooh, it must be this way."
Thank you, NACTA.
It is to code.
Thanks to a group called NACTA, if you want to look them up, NACTO. Anyways, they are providing engineers with alternative standards, which very much align with the Jeff Speck model and
the human scale, the part where we don't kill people with our hurtling pieces of metal.
The director from New York, who is all successful at winning back all those squares and like Times Square and
mm-hmm.
Jeanette Sadiq Khan, I want to.
Sadiq Khan, yeah.
She wrote the book Street Fight.
Mm-hmm.
She was the head of NECTO for a fair amount of time.
Oh.
And so there's that cross pollination that's happening, right? Like, take these things that we've learned in New York and let's start codifying them. So, boom, we got our code fix.
So, 101 rules.
Back to Jeff Speck. So, where we were pushing the envelope of the things that he's been discovering, right? So, when he goes on circuit, right, and he does these talks a lot, largely like what Mahone's doing, coming to here to do our curbside chat, Jeff Speck will do this talk revolving around economics, environmental issues, and personal health issues, all like framing the issues of walkability around these three topics. And so he's been doing that for a long time. And when I pushed him on what other categories are you experimenting with to kind of help broaden the potential audience who might gravitate towards these things, he talked about equity,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about community. Community meaning how do you define your neighborhood that you can access all the things that make your life mostly complete outside of the use of a car. And so if you put this onus of creating these gathering spaces, these social spaces within your neighborhood, and you think about them beyond just the park, right? I think suburbia is really good at doing tract homes around parks, but if you think about all the other things that you need to build a complete community, you're going to put another checkbox on a list of things you need to do in order to have a walkable neighborhood. So I think the equity
yeah.
and community thing are really cool. And then you don't want to just do that just for the wealthy,
The Agrotopia people.
Yeah,
they've done it right, but it's a little exclusive.
Yeah. So
too many people in line for that burrito. Oh God! Have you had the breakfast burrito at the coffee shop at Agrotopia?
I'm not.
We can't go anymore because the line is too long, and I don't have patience for it. But if it is still the same burrito that I had 2 years ago, it's a little bit of a white people breakfast burrito, but it's so good, and their coffee is so good, and their pastries.
Speaking of white people, Mexican, I love how Fox Restaurants just cuts right to the chase and just calls their Mexican restaurant Blanco.
It's in reference to a type of tequila.
So anyway, I understand the deliciousness of the Mexican flavors that are somehow engineered to the white person's palate.
It's like I made it at home.
Anyway, so I thought that part of the course was really interesting, and it's defining your problems and coming up with the appropriate solutions type of checklist. If you can cluster these ideas around problems with economics, problems with environment, problems with your personal health, problems with equity, problems with the community, then you can try to then come up with the little action plans on how to solve these little problems that are broken down into these topics.
And that makes so much sense because, you know, between what Charles Marone and Jeffrey Speck mm-hmm. are talking about is exactly that, You know, we've seen the answer. We know what this looks like. We know how to do it. But no one has really put it together. And groups like Strong Towns and Walkable City, 8 to 80 Cities, you know, I mean, there's now this pantheon of greater urban thinkers, that are greater community thinkers, that are putting together the knowledge that we have gained here in America to good work and say, hey, if we do it like this, we won't go broke.
Right. I see, largely what I see these are is like communication frameworks that can be distilled down into actionable types of approaches.
So one of my questions I have is, what were the types of people in the room? So who chose to come to Harvard to take the class under the tutelage of the great Jeffrey Speck?
So the makeup of the course, or the classroom, was 16 students.
16, okay.
Okay, so...
small, one-on-one, two-day class.
Yeah, it was
16 really on one.
Where I got a lot of one-on-one time with Jeff Speck, which I really appreciated. There was two guys from Florida who were... one was a planner, one was a DOT guy.
Okay.
Whoa. Florida. So
DOT means what?
Department of Transportation. Sorry. So the conversation that I had with the Florida Department of Transportation planner was, hey, all of a sudden, when Florida ranked 50th of all 50 states in car to walk and pedestrian fatality rate, it was a big wake-up call.
You mean they were number one?
Oh, so, yeah.
They were 50, the best.
They were the best at fatalities. They
The death.
The worst at survival rates. That was a wake-up call. And so I was like, wow, that sounds familiar.
You got to hit bottom.
Yeah. And so, you know, if Florida got the message there by hitting bottom and wanting to rebound, and now they're sending their planners to things like Jeff Speck's course, inviting Jeff Speck out to talk to city council in Florida.
And he lived in Miami for a while.
He visited Tampa. He did some active, like, planner activism type stuff in Tampa. And he's really kind of made a name for himself down there. And people respect the message now. They've kind of the message. So that's cool. The other people that were in the room were largely successful developer types who get it.
Oh.
Who get the message that there's a value to be had.
This is how you make money.
This is a value proposition in all this message.
Yeah. Right?
And so...
I hate that term, value proposition. People use it all the time. And I'm not 100% certain that when people use that word, they know what they're talking about. They're like, it'll be sustainable. And I'm like,
that's the one that's used the most, sustainability. I like the term more sustainable.
Less unsustainable.
Yes. I don't think that there's more. You either get there or you don't. In any case...
So it was developers.
The developers are so frustrated with trying to convey the message to the planning types or the cities types who are reviewing their proposals, and it's just they're trying to do good stuff, but it's illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, this
is what we heard in Savannah, too.
This is the story across all great historic cities, right? Like, you walk around what's valued, and it's like, well, you can't build that anymore.
Yeah, downtown Mesa is illegal. Yeah. Downtown Phoenix is illegal. You know, all the historic places, all the community. Savannah is illegal. And their entire economics is based on visiting the historic downtown.
Yeah, 1 square mile that's supporting the other...
Which you literally can't build in Savannah anymore because they're like, oh yeah, you can't do that. That's not to code. And they're like, but everyone comes here, and the property value is fabulous. And
So anyways,
planners, man.
So our contemporaries,
am I right?
Our contemporaries aren't getting it. Like one thing that I just loved outside of the course was walking around Boston. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's great history, and I can go back and I can try to appreciate what the development community or city builders were doing a couple hundred years ago, but it's really hard. Like, I don't understand their context that they were working in necessarily.
Well,
like,
it was, I mean, it really was that there wasn't a true development community. Developer wasn't a job. Architect was, and other things. But you, Ryan, were doing well, wealthily, with your whatever work you were doing, and so you built another building. So you built it, and it became an apartment. You built it, and it was an office. You built it. And so it was a much more fine-grained, small-scale development, and honestly, it probably cost a lot more. I don't think we could build those homes today. Even in high-end, like, New York City, they don't use the same materials.
No, but, I mean, so does the materials necessarily matter, or does the form and the experience and the framing of a place and the space and the
field? Materials matter in that Boston is 300 years old.
So, and I'm coming around to the materials thing, because the materials, I learned, do matter. But it's not necessarily that you have to replicate. You just have to appreciate
what right.
it was about those materials and the textures.
Absolutely.
And the patterns about what those building forms
well, and,
kind of forced to make happen, right?
And a lot of buildings last 100 years and then they just get torn down. Or like most of our spec homes, or what the measurement is, they need to last 30 years. Mm-hmm. Build it to last 30 years. Guys, that's not long. But, you know, there's constant repair and replacement that goes on. So, you know, but some of those homes that were built with certain materiality are 200 years old, 300 years old, mm-hmm. before we were a country kind of thing.
So where I'm getting at with, like, the borrowing from or trying to understand what my contemporaries are doing, what people today are doing to build a city, and in a context like Boston, where you can walk around and appreciate all the things that are working well, are the guys who are building a city today learning from what's been built there in the past? And so there's this one newly developing area that was formerly industrial called Seaside or Seaport, mm-hmm. part of Boston, and it's all glass and metal and very cold. And then the forms of the building do not try to shelter people from the harbor breeze.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it just whips on because of these gracious curvilinear faces of the building just end up creating this wind tunnel effect, and so you're getting the pressure condensed as the buildings are coming closer together at the curve. And this is supposed to be a plaza,
but
the wind is just uncomfortable. And I see this poor little couple, like there's this girl and this guy, and they're outside this cafe, and they're at this black table. It's 89 degrees and humid outside. It shouldn't be uncomfortable. But the wind, and this girl's like barely holding onto her shawl, and she's trying to enjoy this little sandwich. And I'm like, oh, you poor people, like... Aww. Why are you here? You should be back in Old Town Boston where you would actually be comfortable.
They wanted to check it. It's probably very pretty, though. It looks great on Instagram, it's kind of
clean.
Thing.
Yeah, if you go out there and you take their early morning shots without the people being miserable, the architecture...
Well, there's no people that want to be there, right? Like, that's what Niemeyer did in Brasilia. You know, like, people don't want to be near the buildings, and so all the pictures have, like, one guy... Mm-hmm. And this giant building. Same thing with, who is the Calatrava, the Spanish guy?
Oh, okay.
Huge, beautiful buildings that are useless because no one wants to be near them. But, you know, communities like that, just because, you know, maybe it's not the glass and steel, or it's a better use of those materials, but the lack of thought in that humans actually have to use the space between the buildings.
Yeah.
And because of that, without retrofit on top of the tens of millions of dollars that they spent on that street, it's not going to last.
Yeah.
It's going to be torn down. It's going to go to a landfill.
And even the glass, so in retail design, you learn that, like, having this ability to look into the space is really important.
Yes.
One, for the pedestrians who are out on the sidewalk, people who are just passing by, it's an interesting to look in and see what's on the menu, what's for sale, what's on display.
Behavioral whatever. Economics. Get in here and spend your money.
But then this new development, the glass was so reflective that you had to like squint in order to be able to appreciate what was going on inside. And I'm like, oh my god,
it's the future of glass, man.
If it can go wrong, if people can find a way to make it go wrong, they will. Like, you messed up glass. Well,
and it's not just about buying stuff in a shop, right? So it's not just about buying it. It's about building community and seeing right. other people, because community is multiple people right. staring
not
at
yourself.
Each other. Right.
You can just stay home and look in a mirror. Well, it did double the people in the
bar. It went from 3 to 6. If you got it right, they got that infinity mirror. Everyone's here, man.
Between the buildings. That's awesome. They're really small, but
so day two.
Day two. After hearing, well, let's wrap up day one.
Not
so
really.
After hearing the greatest hits, we go and we have this great sit-down restaurant experience with us all around this table at the South End Buttery. And it's really great conversation. The table is really narrow and everybody kind of crowds around it and everybody's like appreciating like that social dimension that's happening across the table. The table is much narrower than even your typical dining room table. So, definitely a little crowded. Like, the place couldn't be too humongous, it wouldn't work. But everything was designed around, like, this social dimension. And even though Jeff Speck was a couple seats down there across the table from me, and George Perekis was 2 seats down at the end of the table from me, we were all still, like, in a the same social circle,
mm-hmm.
and could still communicate with one another. And so it made for very interesting table conversations. And we got into actually the topic of Judaism, because Jeff Speck is Jewish, but he's a modern, practices it in a modern context. And there was another gentleman from Israel who was Orthodox.
Mm.
So they started talking about this Saturday observance for religious purposes, where they don't directly benefit from anything mechanical.
Right, yeah.
So, on Saturday, if you want to have a day with your family, you're not supposed to get in the car to do anything.
Right, you can't drive.
So, it's an interesting thing. In a place where you have a strong Jewish contingency, there's going to be this built-in population who wants a day without a car.
Yeah.
And so,
when downtown Phoenix has communities like that, yeah.
Is an interesting cultural dynamic that ends up lending itself to creating the demand for more walkability.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was something that I learned and was new. It dawned on me.
As to how the religious faith interacted with or influenced the urban form.
Yeah, and then influence being the demand from the population, right? So if the population demands it, that's what we want to build. So it's all about being clear about what you want, what you need, and what you demand. So anyway, that was the wrap up of day two, or day one. And great, great day all in all. We got the tour before the dinner. We did do a tour of historic Boston, Acorn Street. Look that up. That's a really tiny little pedestrian street.
Mm-hmm.
That where the road, the house, the doors are a narrow sidewalk away from a very narrow street, and then you've got the building right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates this very interesting dynamic. Totally illegal. It's not even something that I would advocate that we need to do a lot of. It might be okay in very small segments
to differentiate the yeah,
just to create a little different character mm-hmm. in the community. But yeah, it's certainly, there's no fire truck that can get down it.
I'm sure they developed one.
Yeah. We need a fire bicycle. So that was day one. Day two was a tour of Somerville, and that's where we really got to know George Perekis. And he's the planning director for Somerville.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been leading the charge very much from a new urbanist perspective. The Congress for the New Urbanism, we kind of talked about that as something that we visited in Savannah. And he's been following or been part of the leadership in CNU for quite some time, and they've been able to deliver on modern redevelopment in a sensitive way to borrow from all those historic benefits that we see in Old Town Boston.
Learning from what works.
This was the contrast, right? You had the seaport thing that I would visit, and I was like, man, there's so many things that they're getting wrong. And then we visit Assembly Row in Somerville, where they're doing so many things right. It's still very chain-oriented because that's how financing works. You don't get to finance these types of projects without the big commercial backers.
Right, because the underwriting all happens based on Wall Street standards, yeah. Right.
Which I think that maybe cities' economic development departments could find good responses to.
Congress for the New Urbanism is looking at finance reform as well.
Cool.
So
that could be a topic all on its own, podcast all on its own. But the...
That's a series of podcasts.
What it resulted in was this very successful development where you had this vertical mix of uses, where you had a lot of residents living there. You had a parking garage that was tucked in behind everything and very non-disruptive to the street.
Mm-hmm.
You had these very narrow streets that even choked down even further at the intersections, to where the through lanes were only 9.5 feet in each direction.
How can I fit an 8 foot wide fire truck through in a 9.5 foot lane with an 18 and a 19 foot opening? That's not possible, man.
I guess people just have to respond to the fire truck coming, right?
Those firefighters, you know, they're going to have to practice driving, keep in the lane.
I'm sure they had to apply some sort of training radius.
I will tell you what, that the firefighters are probably the best drivers. They drive that big thing and they can thread a needle with that thing.
So it's doable. And then the plazas that the buildings would create. Jeff Speck talked a lot about like how these buildings are placed in a way where it really forces people's perspective. It draws people in. People are curious what's around the corner. It's not more of the same glass and steel, right? You turn the corner, your eyes or your experience changes a little bit based on the architecture being a little different. So it just makes the walk more interesting. Using his 4 points, comfortable, useful, safe, and interesting being the four elements of walkability. It definitely helps nail down the interesting part.
Yeah.
When you change building forms and change building materials and colors, and he talked a lot about demise lines. So you're talking about like how we build buildings differently than they built back then. You know, they're far less incremental. Of like, you build a building here, and then the next building comes right next to it, and so forth and so forth. It evolves. Well, bigger developments happen quicker today, right? And we throw up these big buildings, and so when you look at the mega block constructions that's going on in like downtown Phoenix, with all the new buildings
across the country,
and across the country, you get these facades that are largely the same for hundreds and hundreds of feet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not as interesting as at least faking that they're looking like different buildings,
and right?
So you talked about how you can use these demise lines to make one massive building look like multiple buildings. And how to do that right, how not to do that right. And, yeah, so, I mean, but the takeaway was that, one, this development ended up happening right on the transit-oriented line, the orange line. So it's very transit-oriented and loud.
Well, transit-oriented is an architectural style. Is it oriented towards transit?
Oriented.
It's near transit, so that means it could be transit oriented if they develop it properly.
It performs like a transit dependent.
Right, there we go. Sorry, I hate people saying, "Oh, it's a transit oriented development." I'm like, no, it means it's oriented towards transit. It's just nearby. Yeah. It can't be. Yeah. It didn't do anything.
In order of like performance metrics, it's doing the right things because they were able to massively reduce the number of parking that the development required. He fought with the biggest employer in Somerville, Prospect Health, mm-hmm. as to their parking ratios for the office space. So here's the interesting thing in how office space is evolving in our world is that people are using office space more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So more people per square foot in an office building, you think that you need to up your parking standards. Well, they have to fight that. They're like, no, we're going to require, you know, people are going to find that it's going to be a little inconvenient to show up by car, and that's by design. But guess what? We have this great orange line that has plenty of untapped capacity.
Right.
And it connects us to our downtown Boston, and everything's going to be great. So it turns out that even after fighting for a greatly reduced number of parking, the parking structure is still only being used about 60% capacity.
And that was probably a third of their development budget.
So, and even where the parking for that little campus is exposed, they did really good, fun things with the architecture on the face of it, mm-hmm. so that it at least helped enclose the feeling of a plaza on their campus.
So it made it feel more, when you walked by it, it was less blank wall-y.
Yeah, and it helps to enclose an outdoor room mm-hmm. On the campus. So it serves a practical function for the creation of space.
Yeah.
So those are some really cool things about that. And then so Somerville is skirted by two really productive transit lines right now, the Red Line and the Orange Line. And there's a Green Line in Boston that's coming right through the center of it. So Somerville is going to go from about 30% a walk shed to a high-capacity transit station to 70%.
Walk shed, you mean 70% of people will be within a convenient walk of correct. Transit.
Right.
High frequency,
well running transit, not like the surface buses that we see around here, right? So
just bring more of them.
And so the center of Somerville has not been thought about as being transit rich, and the land economics and the development patterns around it kind of embody that, right? So how will the urban design and the development change drastically around the middle of Somerville is what they're currently grappling with. So there's this one transit station that they gave us as a design challenge where the topography is crazy. There's this old high school, then it dips down to these commuter tracks where the new Green Line track is going to be lining adjacent to, and then back up a smaller hill to an old gas station that's ready to be redeveloped, a warehouse that needs to be torn down, a beautiful historic building that they call Piano Building or Piano House, something like that, and a very successful restaurant. And how do they make all the synergy work, and how do they make it more connected? And there's this old green that's no longer really usable because it's got this crazy slope to it. So all this new redevelopment opportunities, and how do you make sure that redevelopment happens in a way that, one, it helps the transit station be successful, connects to the high school students with this crazy grade change,
mm-hmm.
And really serves the community and takes advantage of the assets that are currently there with the Piano Building, the very successful restaurant. And so that was a great design challenge. We all talked about, you know, how we would redo the street networks. There's this these really odd intersections that Jeff Speck loves, by the way. He really loves that intersections that don't come to a 90 degree mm-hmm. because they offer this opportunity to alert caution to the driver, right? This is not just something that you can easily navigate.
Can't
just
blow through here at 900 miles an hour.
Slow it down, make sure that you're safe, and when you slow down as a driver and make sure that you're safe, guess what? Everybody benefits. Everybody's mm-hmm. a little safer. So, how do you take all these crazy intersections and crazy street sections that are not really well striped or well designed and make them more useful for everybody and create a place around this transit?
So, briefly, you had said that Jeff was talking about bringing equity into that, and it sounds like in a community like Somerville, I'm not certain, but it sounds like it's a small community, which means that it's either going on the wealthy side, it's, you know, communities that have well-defined boundaries that either end up being fairly wealthy and continue that trajectory, or are historically poverty rich.
So just 10, 15 years ago, Somerville was commonly known as Slummerville.
Ha ha ha.
Ha. So definitely does not have the history of being this place that just is a haven for the well-paid Harvard and MIT professors.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? They're making their way there. And so, yes, as Somerville is now drawing more success and is redeveloping, they are very much equity-minded. And
are they seeing displacement? Or
in order to protect from displacement, they have a very strong inclusionary housing component to all new developments.
Oh.
Something like 20%.
So their state government hasn't made that illegal?
No.
Ooh, interesting.
And oddly enough, everybody who serves on Somerville's council, or they have a different, they're called aldermen?
Aldermen, yeah.
Yeah. Were backed by Bernie Sanders. their whole council. So
what percentage of their city staff do you think lives in Somerville?
I don't know. I know that George Perekis himself lives just on the west or east, just east of the city boundary in another community.
Traitor.
Yeah, but I mean, in a city of 4 square miles,
your housing options are limited.
You can live in the adjacent city and still feel like you're part of the community, right? So, but yeah, the housing stock in Somerville is largely 2 to 4 unit homes that have, maybe if they were developed originally as single family homes, they've evolved into these fourplexes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard so many fun stories. Which ones we have time for?
We have zero time, but
I'll throw out this one. So one of the things about like where planning and zoning regulations can make people go crazy and make the good things illegal is that simply they want to finish their basement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they finish their basement, all of a sudden their floor area ratio that they're allowed to have finished might exceed what's allowed for the size of their lot. This is ridiculous, right? Like, this is already built.
It exists. And I want to improve.
I want to improve. It'll improve the value of my property. You can tax me for it. What's the problem here? So, they have this this woman who has a language barrier issue, and she goes and she, quote-unquote, improves her basement, but she leaves a box of tiles in the corner of a room. It says, it's not finished. you can't say I finished it. It's not. So because there's like a few tiles that are left undone on her floor, she's arguing that.
I don't think the law works that way, but but you know, go for it, man, lady.
So that, I guess that was a fun problem for George and his staff to have to wrangle with.
Well, that sounds like a good way to have an exception to a rule that's overly stringent. Yeah. So, you had an amazing time.
I did.
At that small college outside of Boston.
And I hope that this experience helps improve our podcast and I can continue to tap into these ridiculous stories and fun experiences and really deep thinking about what it takes to build a city right.
And then we're both really excited about having Chuck Marone from Strong Towns coming and doing his curbside chat here in the center of our region in Phoenix.
I hope more people get excited about it and get hooked.
And before that, he's actually at the Regional Policy Council in Wickenburg. Rural policy. After, oh, is it the day after?
Yeah, August 8th, he'll be in Phoenix. And if you want to get involved with that rural talk, head up to Wickenburg August 9th.
Yeah, no, that sounds really exciting. And rural is a microcosm of what we're dealing with in the urban areas because their budgets are smaller. They have to be a lot more careful, a lot more thoughtful than us big spenders. But that's really exciting. So if you see us, if you see two white guys at the Strong Towns meeting in Phoenix on that's August 8th. Just
Main Street Mesa swag.
Just come say hi. we look forward to seeing that, and seeing you, seeing Chuck. I've never been to Valley Bar. I want to go to the library too. That's in there. All right, after party, Valley Bar. That's done. It's the first day of school, man. Just abandon your children. That's the answer. Abandon your wife with the children. We'll bring the kids to Valley Bar. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and please make sure that you have. I have at least two copies of Happy City available. If anyone needs them, let me know. But we'll be back next episode with our next episode of Happy City. I'm David Crye.